John Fain.
On radio, online and on digital.
Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne
and on ABC Victoria.
Joining us on the program as guests, Adelita, who's a founding member of the Geelong band Magic Dirt, who's touring. Magic Dirt, no longer. Well, they're still dirty and they're still magic, but they're just not together as a band. But Adelita, on her solo career, has put out a beautiful CD and she's one of our guests. And our other guest, someone who joined us several years ago, David Webb, who's written what we think is the first book published possibly in the whole world about suicide by someone who has experienced attempting suicide. David Webb is a suicidologist, and he's written the book that some people think shouldn't be published, to talk about something that some people think shouldn't be talked about. He's our second guest joining us on The Conversation Hour today. My co-host for the journey is broadcaster and theatre writer and director Lauren Clark. Good morning to you, Lauren.
Good morning to you, John.
And how's your life? And you're doing a show at Triple R now.
I am, yes. I'm co-hosting a show with Alicia sometimes on Triple R, which is called Oral Texts. Oral Text? I got the name of the show wrong. Oral Text, and it's on Wednesdays, so once a week. It keeps you on your toes working for radio, doesn't it?
Nah.
Don't you think so?
Walk in the park.
Well,
just come to work, sit down, start talking, go home. I mean, what could be easier?
It is easy. It's wonderful. I love it.
Just call it work. Don't tell them, but I mean, really.
I've read more books since I started doing this show than I think I've read the entire rest of, not my life, but the year. Because you do tend to, it's stimulating, and you want to get guests on who are interested in talking about new and different things. Mm. And so you want to know what they're talking about before they get there. And then it keeps you informed at least about whatever it is you're talking about. And oral text is about, it's about writing and literature and spoken word and spoken word performance and so on. So it is something that interests me, and there are areas of it that I'm familiar with, and areas of it in which I'm singularly ignorant.
So. Someone who used to write speeches for politicians once told me that it takes 2 days to write a good 20-minute speech.
Mm. Mm. Well, I find, I mean, as a writer, I think that actually the editing process is sort of one of the hardest things, and getting something down to a shorter piece is very difficult. I found that I've written a couple of essays for Mianjin, and they were sort of 6,000 words or thereabouts.
You can waffle a bit, really, can't you?
And yeah, and actually that's edited down. You should have seen the original versions. But that's a skill that, so writing a really punchy 20-minute speech, mm-hmm, is, I imagine, harder in a way than writing a long-winded one that goes for an hour and probably doesn't include nearly as much and isn't nearly as sort of dramatic, doesn't carry as much dramatic punch. So
most people who deliver speeches don't realise, though, that it's a theatrical performance. It's not about the content so much. It's often about the style.
And the pauses.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're performing a speech. You're not delivering a speech.
No, that's right. That's right. And some people can read the phone book and it's just intrinsically hilarious, or, you know, really packs a punch dramatically. Yep. And some people can read a Churchill speech and put you to sleep. So lecturers and teachers are good at all of that. You know, I
mean, should be.
Good lecturers and good teachers are good at all that.
Come on, you can count the good ones on one hand, can't you?
Well, I must say, I have been blessed with some great teachers. When I was in primary school, I was, how old would I have been? Probably, if you're in primary school, you're younger than 12. My teacher in grade 4, 5, 6, she used to read to us. Whenever it rained outside, she used to read to us, and we would just not go out. We'd go out later, I think.
Wet
I can't really quite
table.
Remember how this worked, but I remember, and it would be sort of dark and stormy, and she'd be reading The Highwayman Comes Riding, or she'd read you, what else did she read? Read us epic poems and adult books that I later found out are, you know, not young adult fiction. She was actually reading us really quite sophisticated and stories that I wasn't entirely necessarily picking up on all the nuances of. But just having that, that was a real gift, particularly to me, because it was something that I was interested in. But
well the art of teaching is massively undervalued, and the whole idea that you can actually teach teachers how to teach better and teach them some of the tricks that actors use to get people's attention and hold their attention and deliver a message is that's a fairly recent invention, actually, that notion.
It is, and I imagine...
I mean, lecturers used to just drone.
Yeah, that's right, and I think that probably is very helpful for people to learn tricks and so on, because I tell you what, it's terrifying. I've spoken at schools and like taught the odd, taken a class, a drama class every now and then or something, because I do a bit of theatre directing as well, and I'm not an unconfident performer in my everyday existence, and I've been on stage before and so on, but there is something about the honest glare of a teenager or somebody who's even younger than a teenager, there's nowhere for you to move. You know that if you look tentative or nervous or anything for even a second, you're in all sorts of trouble.
Oh, yeah, they're like dogs that can smell if you're frightened.
Yeah, they really are.
Jump on you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And at least when you write a play, which is where most of my performance sort of instinct goes, you've got your writing. You think, it's okay, this next bit's coming up. You know, I know this next bit's going to work, or if it doesn't work, then I know that this next bit's going to be interesting in some way, or the actor's going to relax into it or something. Mm. But when you don't have that, you can see why teachers do lesson plans and really...
Well, I actually think in school kids should all be taught performance, and, you know, your drama class, which was always the sort of, you know, goof-off option.
Mm.
In fact, whether you're going into business, going into... you know, public sector, private sector, it doesn't matter what your walk of life is. You've got to be able to communicate with people, and, you know, your drama and classes like that is about communicating, getting people's attention, finding a way of getting your message across. And
that's
whether
right.
you're talking to colleagues, talking to the boss, talking to staff, talking to traders, doesn't matter what you're doing, whether you're a builder or working in a shop, it doesn't matter what you're doing. At some point, you've got to be able to properly communicate, and sometimes that involves an element of performing.
It does.
We massively undervalue it. You know, the Americans do it much better. You know, right from an early age, kids have to stand up and talk confidently to class, or learn how to speak confidently in front of other people and talk to the class, and they're much less self-conscious than we are.
Well, they also, the Americans... When I went on exchange when I was studying to America and studied politics. And
secondary or tertiary?
Tertiary.
Okay. Where'd you go?
Boston College.
Oh, great fun.
I know, it was actually. It was enormous fun. And I was studying politics and English and so on over there. And I would say something, and one of my friends or someone in the class or a teacher would say, "Oh, Lauren, don't be so hard on yourself." And I'd think, but I wasn't being hard on myself, but I realised that I was being self-deprecating.
Oh, they don't get
and
that.
And they don't get that. And I used to think that was because they didn't understand irony or something. But actually, if you get used to performing like that, you know, existing like that, saying, yes, actually, I'm good at this, then it sort of becomes true and people believe you. And that is something that they're
doesn't
actually...
doesn't mean you are good at it, though.
No, but that's true. That's true. But that's that performance thing.
Yeah. But Americans, they always, they talk everything up. They do. Everything's fabulous and terrific.
And I found it so surprising that people who I would think of as sort of relatively shy comparative to, say, me, that they would say, but that's what I'm really good at.
Mm.
And you'd think, wow, did you just say that? Because that's not something that's said here. And I think there's something to be said for that, because a lot of the time here there's a kind of a, no, really, I'm not really that good kind of a competition. Yeah. It's almost the other way around.
Yeah, maybe there's something in between.
Yeah, there's got to be a happy
medium.
Got to
be something in between. Yeah, there certainly does. Lauren Clark, writer-director, and now at Triple R, doing a spoken word show called Oral Text on Wednesdays, is my co-host on The Conversation Hour today. Australia's only, I think, suicidologist, David Webb. His book has just been published, and there are those who think that it would have been a better world if David's book was not published. Indeed, there are those who think it's dangerous to talk about that which David has made his life study after his own personal experiences. He'll tell you more when he joins me and Lauren in the studio. But first up, yes, she's one of those performers who just gets known by her first name only, Adelita, one of the members of the former band Magic Dirt, with a self-titled CD just released as her solo career kicks off, Adelita, our first guest on The Conversation Hour.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Joining Lauren Clark, my co-host, and myself, I'm John Fain. On The Conversation Hour today, Adelita, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You're here because of your singing, but what have you done to your hand?
Oh, yeah. I bought a new appliance, one of those sort of Barmix stick mixer things, and there was a few buttons on there, and it was new. I didn't know what one of the buttons was for. I thought it was a release button for the blade. And, yeah, had my fingers wrapped around it. And
no.
It's all right. It's still on. Fingers on.
So what did you actually do?
Just slice through it a bit.
One finger?
Yeah. My guitar playing finger.
No.
Oh, that's devastating.
How long ago?
About 3 weeks ago. Oof.
It's a very impressive piece of, what is it, a sort of splint. Plastic splint thing.
Yeah, I know. It looks a bit Android-y.
It does a bit.
So you were holding it
yeah.
by one hand while you tried, you thought to undo yes. it, but actually turned it on with the other.
Yep.
What do you like with lawnmowers?
I'm okay with lawnmowers, just not stick mixers.
What happens to a musician when they lose their instrumenty bit?
They get very sad yeah. and frustrated and panicked. I thought I'd done the whole, thought I'd chopped the whole thing off actually, but yeah. it took me a while to... You know, I was running it under the water and was looking, didn't want to look at it and thought, oh no, what have I done? But luckily, I think I got away pretty lightly.
Yeah, very lucky.
Plastic surgery?
I did get surgery, yeah.
Nerves mm-hmm. and things
yep.
cut?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. You yeah. did a proper job.
Yeah, I did a real good job.
So in enforced break, does that mean?
Or? No, I'm still working. I've got a friend of mine who played on my record, who JP Shiloh, who's playing guitar for me. So he's learned my songs and we seem to be going okay that way. So show must go on.
And yeah. does that mean you're going to have to do rehab and all sorts mm-hmm. of other things? You may never get back to the sort of proficiency that you had before.
No, well.
There'll be pre and post accident Adelita.
Yeah, there will be. I'm a changed woman. I feel different. But I've got to do my finger rehab soon. So I'm looking forward to that. But got to take it slow.
I did that when I was 9 years old. See that you could, this is great radio.
Oh, I can see.
You can see a giant scar across my finger. I nearly
little finger right hand.
Little finger
hold
right
that
hand.
So everyone can see it on the radio. Yeah.
and a little bit on the finger next to it. When I was 9 years old, almost severed it. And I used to play the oboe. And I was, even when I was nine, and I really loved playing the oboe. I played it for quite some time. And that was a real, because there's a lot of finger work involved, of course. And I had to do the exercises. And as long as you do the exercises.
No, you've got to tell us how you nearly cut your finger off. Come on, Lauren. You can't just gloss over that.
I will. But it's amazing how quickly it happens. Yeah. I assure you. Mm. I cut my finger off because I'm an idiot. I was at school. And I was making a giant papier-mâché head for my grandparents. I have no idea why. I was obviously just some art project kind of thing. And I was my hands were covered in glue. And I thought, you know what? I've just made a giant papier-mâché head and it's very attractive and so on, but it doesn't serve a function, a purpose. What I should do is turn it into a money box. So I went and got a knife.
Of course.
Oh.
I went and found a knife in the little school kitchen, which was a steak knife.
Of course.
And reached up into the air and slam. My hands were covered in glue. My hands slipped down the blade.
And so your hand on the handle with glue on it slid down the blade itself.
Yep, that's right.
And you then severed through your little finger.
Yes. I cut through the tendon. And
you did.
And my I had plastic surgery, which I always enjoy telling people.
What a gruesome program this is.
What would he be called? Surgeon. My surgeon was called Dr. Stapleton, which is most amusing because he almost does look like it's been a bit stapled together. But I assure you that it works perfectly well now.
It gives me hope, because I severed through the tendon
yes.
and the nerve and the bone.
Yeah, right. So you did pretty much the
yeah.
same thing.
And like the bone.
And the bone, I didn't yeah. touch my bone.
Yeah,
wow.
It was really sharp blade.
Wow.
But I'm really glad to hear that you've recovered fully there because yeah. I need this finger.
Yeah, yeah. You'll get it back.
Was there talk of letting it go?
No. No, no. They were like, oh, that's fine.
Did you have to kind of cradle your hand and carry the bits in to the hospital?
No, they didn't. There was no bits. It was just very cleanly kind of sliced.
Hanging
almost.
By a thread?
No, not hanging.
But you went through the bone, you said?
Yeah, but the top, just at the top, fingertip. But yeah, they're like, no, that'll be fine. Some people come in with the blade still in their, you know, fingers. So I was pretty lucky.
Can we play some? No.
Anyway.
No, you didn't come in to talk about self-mutilation, no. Although that might be the theme that we pick up with our next guest, David Webb, who talks about similar things and has been there and done that as well. I hadn't realised there was this recurring theme. In fact, it's funny how things do emerge. Tell us about the band. Tell us about Magic Dirt. And do you all still talk to each other, or was it a messy breakup?
It wasn't a messy breakup. Our bass player passed away a couple of years ago, so we obviously feel very lost without him. He was a founding member, and he was, you know, he was kind of really good at directing the band's, you know, projects. And, you know, Dean was our life, so without him we feel...
Have you never performed since?
We did some tribute shows around, and we did the Big Day Out as a tribute run as well, and then we stopped. So I guess you could say we're on hiatus. Yeah.
And you're not ruling out maybe being together again?
But I think as the days pass more and more, it feels like it'll be hard to ever contemplate getting on stage again as a band.
So that was that, and this is then.
I think so. I think it's heading that way. Right. Yeah. But you never know. There might be a kind of another tribute sort of, or a revisiting possibly, but not for a while.
And is this new? You've done solo work before, but this is a new thing for you. Does it feel new and different, or is it great that you have all those years of playing, you know, amazing music with amazing famous bands behind you? Do you feel like now you get to sort of be you and experiment and find new?
Oh, it feels really different.
Does it?
It feels like I'm starting from scratch, and you know, it's been a real challenge. I think, you know, Dean and I, basically Dean, you know, brought up, you know, why don't you try doing, you know, some solo stuff, and that sparked it in my mind. So it's very new, and I feel like I'm sort of honouring our project that we started together, and it's kind of taken on a life of its own now. But no, I feel like a different person, like not the same person as I was in Magic Dirt. Mm. But
is that part of grief, part of loss, part of life?
I think so. Yeah, I think I'm still working through it, or I don't know if I'll ever work through it. But yeah, I feel close to Dean while I'm playing music and doing this project in particular, so it keeps me connected to our very strong creative bond that brought us together in the first place, you know, 20-odd years ago.
20 years,
yeah.
And there's something proudly Geelong about the music that you're recording still and identifying very strongly with your roots down in Geelong and the band's roots down in Geelong. And the film clip that I saw was all filmed down the refinery, and was it the point, what's the name of that, Point Henry, was it around there, or the salt?
Yeah, the Cheatham Salt Works. Yeah.
Down along the beaches, all that area.
Yeah, the North Shore area, yeah.
Putting it on display.
Yeah, I'm fascinated with Geelong. I have very strong roots there. And both my clips for Repair and Hot Air I have filmed in and around Geelong.
And the industrial seascape.
Yeah, there's some amazing vistas down there. Just, yeah, that sort of industrial areas, the neglected backwater bits, and just some stunning areas. And I feel a very strong heart connection with Geelong, and it feels good to bring it into the present.
Well, yeah. It's almost like a tribute.
It is. It is very much so, yeah. And it felt very natural. It's just always in my mind's eye, making this record.
So did you direct, in a way, did you direct the film clip as well as doing the performing?
Co-directed, yeah. Adam Harding is also from Geelong, the director.
Oh, it's a conspiracy. Yeah,
it is. So, yeah, it felt very good. And, you know, we know all the spots. You know, we're locals, so, yeah.
And do you feel a bit brave?
Yeah, I do. I think especially getting on stage is the hardest part at the moment.
Yeah,
you know, okay. With Magic Dirt, it was just second nature. Just didn't think about it. Mm. Get on, rock out, you know, headbang, play loud, get off, sweaty, great.
Right, but big group of you.
Yeah, you know, a gang. But doing the solo thing, just some of the shows I've been doing, I just am so traumatized when I get off stage, but in a really good way. Yeah. Where I don't know if traumatized is the right word, but extremely energized, like an overwhelming kind of, you know, nervous. Response to what I'm doing. So, you know, doing the Blondie Pretenders tours, you know, in front of such a big audience, and I was just kind of starting the solo shows, so really got thrown into the deep end, but I accepted the challenge. But, you know, I feel like I'm getting more and more confident as each show passes.
Well, congratulations. Adelita, the new CD is out. And it's dedicated to Dean, which is a very beautiful thing to do. And Adelita Sosen, formerly with Magic Dirt, her self-titled solo album is out now. She's touring due to play. You're still going to tour?
I am still going to tour.
One-handed?
Yes. I've got guitar mates. They can help me out.
Mount Hotham on the 30th of July. That's a tough gig. Melbourne in the city on the 13th of August. Off she goes around the place, even with one hand. And I have any number of text messages for you. Sounds like Richard Stubbs' World of Pain on a Friday afternoon, which is true, I might say. And people saying, oh, what is it with you boys and your desire for gory details? And Linda, mother of an electrical apprentice, says, what is it with you people? Before you stick your fingers in a food processor, don't you have the common sense to unplug it or turn the power off? Yeah, right. Okay, thanks very much for that. We'll all just take that as something we've learned the hard way. Lauren Clark, presenter with Triple RFM, writer and director, my co-host, and Adelita, touring around. The new CD, simply called Adelita, is in the shops now. Our next guest, David Webb. He's written a book. It's his PhD, but it's based on his personal experiences and what he's learned since experiencing suicidal thoughts and impulses many years ago and surviving his attempts to take his own life. David calls himself a suicidologist. And this is the book that some people think should never have been written about a topic that some people think we shouldn't talk about. David Webb, our next guest on The Conversation Hour.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Adelita and Lauren. Lauren Clark and Adelita Sosen were our first guests and co-host. And now David Webb is a person whose PhD thesis has just been published. Now, very often when people have their PhD published, it's got a print run of 4 or 6 or maybe 20, and it circulates amongst only those people who care about, you know, research into fruit fly reproduction or whatever it might be. David's work, though, is very different. It's about suicide based on his own personal experiences, because David calls himself a suicidologist. David, welcome back to The Conversation Hour.
Hi, John. Thanks.
I remember the first time we met, how many years ago, I don't know.
2006.
2000, well, you do remember. And I'd never heard anyone speak about suicide the way you did. It was quite startling. What's your general approach for those who are fresh to the conversation?
Well, I guess my PhD is motivated by my own history with fairly persistent suicidality for quite a long time. And so my work really tries to bring the voice of those people who have that experience, have that knowledge, the first-person knowledge, the lived experience, into our understanding of suicide and suicidal feelings. Because I was struck how little you actually heard from suicidal people in the study of suicide.
And sometimes for very good reasons, I might say.
Yes, I've learnt some of those reasons since myself. There's tremendous, well, typically the word is stigma, that I think should more accurately be called discrimination or prejudice. So I think it's either a brave or foolish person that fesses up about their own suicidal history.
It's a rare person who can speak so coherently about it too, because a lot of people are unable to express the sorts of thoughts and feelings that you are able to express with hindsight.
Yeah, and it took a long time. Doing a PhD was about, four years work, something like that. And to find the words for my story, it's quite a slim volume, that. I mean, there's millions of words that have been thrown away with the help of my PhD supervisors. and then revising it for commercial publication, it got hacked around again. So distilling them into what we now have in that book has been quite a journey in itself.
Well, it's more than a journey, and your life is more than a journey. In essence, though, you say that much good, having the right sort of conversation about suicide can be a positive rather than a negative, and a lot of the taboos that we've just generally associated with that whole conversation, we've just got to address them because we're in the middle of some sort of a crisis, and I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, just in the last year or so, see, for years I've been saying that we need to talk about suicide, get it out of the closet as a public health issue, and I've been saying that is that's the first step before coming up with a better response, a better interventions, if you like, a better way. But in the last year or so, I've really started to think that talking about suicide is actually suicide prevention. Because I found myself asking, another thing that I was saying in my research was that the key to suicide prevention is what we might call mentally healthy communities. Mm-hmm. And then I asked myself, what would a mentally healthy community look like? And I realised one of the important things that it would look like is that it's a community that's capable of having a sensible conversation about suicide. Now, that doesn't happen very often these days. So I actually see talking about suicide in a sensible way as, in fact, suicide prevention. Community prevention.
Not just individualised, but across the community.
I think for people who are feeling suicidal, to hear the community that they live in talking sensibly about it is a tremendous safety valve. It gives them somewhere to go. We're typically, we're underground, we're hiding from our feelings, we're hiding from perhaps our family, friends, we're hiding from the services that might be able to help us. But if there's an open communication, open conversation around this topic in the community, then it just makes it easier, I think, for people to speak about their feelings sooner rather than later. Mm.
I notice in the book you go out of your way several times to say that it's a very personal experience for each individual, and so therefore you're reticent to give advice to people who are feeling these feelings. Mm. But what advice you do give is for people who are around those people and who aren't feeling like that and who are confused by it. And you say, I think it's active listening and really... And how do you do that?
I think the phrase I use is honest listening. And it's a bit like active listening, I think. If someone does share with you their feelings that they're thinking about maybe chucking it in, then that's a pretty scary thing. Mm. Because I'm... speak publicly about this, I do get approached by people out of the blue and over the net, and it's pretty scary. And I think we need to be honest about that and not pretend that it's not scary. And usually if I'm talking to someone who's feeling suicidal, somewhere in the conversation, I'll say, well, what you're saying's spooking me out a bit here, because my feelings are a part of that conversation as well. So it's about being really, I think, quite ruthlessly honest with what's happening, and not hiding from all of the stuff that's going on. We just hide from it all the time. And a lot of people's reaction is anything but suicidality. If we can find any other possible explanation that we can... used to not face up with what might be going on here, then we tend to cling to that. And that's some of the myths that you have around suicide. It's just attention-seeking behaviour and so on.
Or a mental illness in itself, rather than just the manifestation of something else. You describe it as a crisis of the self.
I one of the key arguments of my work is to try and put forward the idea that I say suicide and feeling suicidal is best understood as a crisis of the self. Mm. Just that's a better starting place to try and have this conversation from what's the prevailing view that we have at the moment, which is that suicide is the consequence of some notional mental illness. Mm. That's the view that many people have and take for granted, and it's a view that's heavily promoted. And I just think it's unhelpful.
Well, unhelpful and, in fact, even making things worse in many instances. Australia's position on the league table of countries that are dealing with an epidemic suggests that whatever it is that we're using at the moment as a standard response is just plain not working.
I'm not sure that there is an epidemic. It's really hard to identify what's going on. There's certainly an epidemic of the diagnosis of mental illness, mm-hmm. and there's an epidemic of the treatment of the so-called mental illness with psychiatric medications. But whether we've got an epidemic, that is, you know, huge increases in suicidality or the so-called mental illnesses of depression and so on, it's really hard to know because the criteria used to give people these labels are just getting broader and broader and broader. And almost anybody qualifies for a psychiatric label these days. There's a joke amongst some of my buddies. There's two sorts of people in the world, those with a psychiatric diagnosis and those who haven't got theirs yet.
Don't mind that.
There are a couple of things in the book that took me by surprise, and in fact, one of them delighted me, which is your description of when you sort of let go and allowed yourself to feel how you felt. And there are a couple of pages there where you just say, I just was laughing all the time, mm-hmm. and I was just and that release, I suppose the release of that valve or whatever it is so palpable as a feeling that you get across, and that's actually what you were sort of searching for, but you almost had to not be concentrating so much on it in order to get that. Is that right? Is that how it felt to you?
Yes, sort of. One of the other heresies that I talk about, because it's true, I am a bit of a dissenting voice within the field. I'm not altogether comfortable with the title of suicidologist, but is that my own recovery, if I can call it that, came about through what I now call spiritual self-inquiry. So a big motivation for my PhD was to try and bring some spiritual ideas into the thinking about suicide. Now that is really crazy. It's tough enough talking about it on the street, but to try and do that in the university against the medical profession that's saying something else, that's seriously crazy. But so what you described there is when through my own spiritual journey and I popped out the other side, and it was kind of hilarious. I felt like a complete dope, and I'd been a complete dope for like what it was 45 years, but it didn't matter. The embarrassment of my stupidity didn't matter because it was just such a delight to be free and to realize that I didn't have to do anything other than just be me, and there is nothing easier than just being you. We make huge effort and give ourselves a really hard time trying to be something other than who we are, and it can really rip you to shreds, particularly if something happens in your life that sort of throws you off centre a bit. So, yeah.
Well, things happen that throw you off centre, but they're actually probably not that important, but you can't see that at the time. Isn't that part of the problem?
Look, for me, the trigger has been breakup of a significant love relationship,
yep.
which is not unusual.
Yep.
The
triggers are sometimes financial, sometimes work-wise, sometimes personal relationship-wise, or a combination of those.
Yeah, a lot of one, and we see it in the mental health area a lot, is people who are struggling with early childhood trauma of all sorts of kinds mm-hmm. that quite often manifests later in life with a profound discontent and unease with their sense of self.
And
if you then add to that some other life circumstances, the things like you say, you get sacked at work or you break up with your spouse or, you know, other unfortunate events that are just part of the ebb and flow of life for many people, and it just can push you over the edge if it's a bit too much.
Yeah, and then the medicalisation of it all is the other thing. And what's your view of psychiatrists and psychiatry? And we've only got 13 minutes till the news.
I think the medicalisation of suicide is the other major obstacle to the sensible conversation that my work calls for, because reducing the huge mysterious complexity of what it is to be a person to a medical diagnosis, and particularly the psychiatric diagnoses, which have very little science to justify them, is a very big call, and it's being very heavily promoted by people like Beyond Blue and the medical profession and what I sometimes call the suicide prevention industry. But it just doesn't stand up to scrutiny, and I think it actually diminishes us as people, all of us.
It's all well-meaning, though. I mean, you can see that much, surely.
Well-intentioned, but the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Yeah. But people are doing what they think is the right thing. It's just your view is that sometimes some of those measures make things worse, not better, for some people.
First of all, to get that psychiatric label can be a very difficult thing. They're very sticky labels that tend to stay with you for the rest of your life.
That's the stigma thing.
They carry a lot of baggage with them. Yeah. Then there's the treatments that come with that.
You mean drug treatments?
Typically it's drug treatment, but there's also ECT is often used for people who are sort of so depressed that the drugs don't seem to be making any progress with it.
How much do we use that these days?
Oh, a lot, and it's on the up. And the other dimension of it is when these treatments, including ECT, are being imposed on people without their consent. So
I didn't think that was allowed to happen anymore. Someone has to consent.
No.
You're not capable of consenting, someone consents on your behalf.
People, I think that about 100 times a week in Melbourne, someone is given ECT without their consent. It's on the increase.
Because they're in a position where their consent can't be obtained. It's given on their behalf by someone who...
By the treating psychiatrist.
Or a family member who says, yes, we've got no choice here.
No, if they're an involuntary patient under our Mental Health Act, it's the treating psychiatrist that consents. That's the law.
But isn't the family practice someone has to... I mean, you've been admitted to a hospital, and even if involuntarily, there's still some... Isn't there some family involvement in all of those decisions?
No, the final decision is with the psychiatrist. They may consult with the family. The person concerned may or may not be happy about the family being consulted. They may or may not be happy about the family influencing the psychiatrist. But the final decision is with the treating psychiatrist.
And we still do psychosurgery, or what used to be called lobotomy, from time to time as well.
Psychosurgery, I don't know much about that, but it's much more heavily controlled. It needs to be approved by every single instance of it needs to be approved by a board.
Mental Health Review Board, I think, or someone similar. The Psychosurgery Review Board, I think it's a different one again.
I'm not sure whether it is the Mental Health Review Board, but...
Yeah, I think it's called the Psychosurgery Review Board. It's like a separate body.
And it's very rare. It does... And I don't think it ever occurs without consent, but I'm not altogether sure about that. But the big numbers are in drug treatments.
Yep.
Over 5,000 people in Victoria on community treatment orders.
Yep.
Taking very powerful and quite potent and dangerous drugs against their consent.
Do you concede that sometimes, though, some of those people are helped by those treatments?
For me, the issue is not... The drugs, it's the consent. That's the critical human rights issue.
Sure, I guess it comes down to whether or not you think the method is justified by the outcome.
I know people who take the medications. I'm never going to take them again myself because they definitely made life worse for me. But I know people who take those medications, and they're an important part of them managing their difficulties. And I've got no objection to that at all. I mean, it would be a bit hypocritical of me, who's self-medicated with illegal drugs, to say, oh, you mustn't take those nasty prescribed drugs. To me, what works? The problem is that when you've got people out there saying that you've got a chemical imbalance of the brain, which is not scientifically justified statement to make, and these drugs will fix that chemical imbalance of the brain, and that's not a scientifically justified thing to say either, that's when we've got some seriously dangerous myth-making occurring. But antidepressants, I think, should be called psychological painkillers. And in the same way, when you break a leg, it's a really good idea to have some morphine. But the morphine's not going to fix the broken bone. Similarly, the antipsychotic drugs, they're probably more accurately called major tranquilizers. And if your head's running hot and you're hearing things and you're running scared, terrified, whatever's going on for you, maybe those so-called antipsychotic drugs, those major tranquilizers, are useful to try and turn down the volume on whatever's going on in your mind for a while. But they're only a temporary sort of... they don't cure anything.
It's an extraordinary area that we're delving with here, David, and you've been... over the years now regarded as a pioneer, and you've been asked to join government advisory boards and bodies and all the rest of it, and I think you've travelled overseas a bit too, talking about these sorts of issues in a way that in the past just nobody did. Has anyone ever said to you, you must not say these things, stop it?
Not quite as broadly as that. I mean, a few people have said, perhaps not directly to my face, but they say that what I'm saying is dangerous, to which my response is not saying it is more dangerous.
And are you winning that argument?
No, you say I sit on boards and things. Not much. I'm off to Berlin in September for a conference of psychiatric survivors, and then I've been invited to do some workshops in New York later in the year if I can get there. And I'm winning this argument in some circles, but within the mainstream of mental health and, you know, the Pat McGorries of this world, I'm not winning the argument. I'm actually not even allowed into the room to make the argument. There's this wall of silence around the status quo that doesn't want to engage with critical voices such as mine.
And part of that, I think, is also, it's not just the stigma about people who have previously had a diagnosis, but it's that whole, we're the professionals, we control the knowledge, we know what's best for everybody, and we don't have to listen to people who claim to have just learned from just personal experience. I mean, that's not valid.
Yeah, I mean, God help me from experts. So there is no walk of life where, you know, the lived experience is not considered an important part of what we need to understand.
Yeah.
But it's almost absent from mental health in general. The consumer perspective is real, still very tokenistic. And
It's a very difficult coterie, if I can use the language that's applied. I mean, here you've got a coterie of people who are specifically within that coterie because they're thought to be crazy. So, there's every reason to discount every input that they claim that they want to have.
One of the reasons.
It's kind of circular. It used to be a crime to try to commit suicide. You used to, not only did you have to deal with whatever made you attempt it, but then afterwards, if you did survive, you were prosecuted and dragged through the courts. I mean, how ridiculous was that?
Yeah, about as ridiculous as medical labels. But one of the things that you do sort of see said, and it's sometimes implicit more than explicit, is that people with the lived experience, people like me, people who have lived with and come out the other side of suicidal feelings, don't have anything useful to say about the study of suicide because, by definition, I'm crazy. And apart from being incredibly offensive, it's really poor science, you know, and just not true. People with mental health issues, people who live with suicidal feelings, people who experience any aspect of what it is to be human, have something valuable to contribute. But we don't think about these things and talk about these things according to the medical criteria of randomised control trials and all that sort of stuff, which makes sense for testing new drugs. They're just useless for exploring the silent, invisible worlds of our personal feelings.
I've got about 20 text messages for you, David, and they're all along similar themes. There's a few who say that we shouldn't be talking about this, but most of them are saying how brave, I feel fantastic, I'm hearing someone for the first time talk in ways I can understand, and so on and so on. Look, congratulations on having the courage to pursue the sort of the line of inquiry that you're insisting upon, David. And if people want to get hold of the book to learn more about it, how do they do so now that it has at last been published?
It was published in the UK last year, and it's taken a while to find an Australian distributor, and they're in Sydney. There's a few bookshops in Melbourne that have it, but go to your local bookshop and ask them to get it. There's some in a warehouse in Sydney. You should be able to get them pretty quickly.
David Webb's book, it's called Thinking About Suicide. It's published by PCCS Books, whoever they are there in the UK, Thinking About Suicide. But any decent bookshop can look them up on the computer and get hold of some of those copies. David Webb's book has, it's a sort of an amended version of his PhD thesis. I should call you Dr. Webb. Congratulations.
I only ever use that title when I'm in a room full of medical doctors.
And good on you for doing so too. Thinking About Suicide, Contemplating and Comprehending the Urge to Die, Dr. David Webb's PhD thesis, now published PCCS Books, if you're looking for it. Adelita Serson from Magic Dirt has her solo CD out now, and she's touring around with her mangled finger. And Lauren Clark, survivor of plastic surgery as well, has been my co-host for the Conversation Hour today. Thank you all for coming on 774 ABC Melbourne, ABC Victoria. This has been your Conversation Hour.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available at abc.net.au/Melbourne. Subscribe now and you'll receive automatic updates with special guests, interesting interviews. It's a bit of fun. You'll be mad not to subscribe. abc.net.au/Melbourne.